Unfortunately, I saw the red blinking light in time to change the turn of the cassette over, so we can begin where we left off.
Secretary General Hammarskjöld is said to have had one deep regret about the crisis between the United States and the Soviet Union over the Congo. And that was the Soviet Union's break in relations with him had denied him any opportunity to try to do something about this situation.
I don't quite understand why were the Russians so angry with him over the Congo?
Because they wanted to get a foothold in Africa, and particularly in the Congo, because it was so rich, Katanga.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, they backed Lumumba and Shambi in the
Katanga. Yeah, except that the part of the Congo which they actually went into was the northern part, Stanleyville and so forth. Oh. But they were interested in the Congo as a whole.
Then they were willing to have an unholy alliance with the Union Miniere then,
yeah,
is that right?
I think so.
I'm not sure about that, but
because they were the major interest in there, weren't they?
But there were so many other powers, including the United States, I think, which had some kind of an unholy alliance.
But I remember hearing that Dag Hammarskjöld said that he wanted to be sure that communism was kept out of the Congo, and that would mean he'd have to side with the United States. And the United States was using him for a while.
Yes, certainly Hammarskjöld's great fear was that the Congo would become a theater of confrontation between forces that were owed allegiance to the United States and the Soviet Union, and that could have led to a direct conflict between the two great superpowers.
Mm-hmm. Especially in Africa, which was very dangerous.
Well, I'm sorry, I interrupted you, or rather Lee interrupted you, but
I did.
Well, you see how much Dag Hammarskjöld depended on private diplomacy and quiet diplomacy, whichever you want to call it, because he said that he did not have an opportunity to try to work out this big power crisis, and that was one of his great regrets. And he couldn't talk to the Russians in particular, because they had decided they weren't going to recognize him anymore in order to try to get him out of office before he was killed.
So how did they get together on Waldheim and after?
The Security Council got together on Waldheim. There were only, I think he was one of two candidates. The other one was from Finland.
And yes, and very very good candidate.
Yes,
I can't remember his name for the moment.
Max Jacobson, wasn't it? Max Jacobson, who was Foreign Minister of Finland?
Yes.
He was the other candidate.
And who had made a wonderful Secretary General.
Yeah. But the United States and the Soviet Union fixed on Kurt Waldheim. And as a consequence, there was no major opposition to him in the Security Council.
Well, why do you think they favored him?
Excuse me, I there was opposition to him. Major. I understand that in the secret ballots which the Security Council takes on such matters, that for 13 ballots, both the United Kingdom and China, as permanent members, voted against Waldheim.
Oh, really?
And so there was considerable opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what made them both cave in. But it was when they both caved in and, that Hammarskjöld was up. And when he was up for re-election, he failed the last time, because only one permanent member of the Security Council refused to go along with him, and that was China.
Oh.
But why do you suppose both the United States and Russia favored Waldheim's candidacy?
Well, there are all kinds of rumors about. Who knows? I don't know anything at first hand.
Well, here again, I think we're wandering away from our subject, which is commercial.
Well, but I think it shows how it's almost an accident when you get a completely a neutral man who is named the Secretary General.
Well, it's an extremely difficult, as Pauline explained to us earlier, the requirement of the concurring votes of all five
Security Council members.
But largely the superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union. I think Waldheim was a rare, I hope it was a rare occurrence.
Oh, they'll probably strike all that, I should think. But you were talking freely before, and you both said that you felt that both the United States and Russia were aware of Waldheim's background.
Well, that's what Norman said.
That's speculation.
What is the speculation?
Aware of his background, and therefore they could control him better.
Uh-huh.
That's what Norman said. Now, I'm not surprised at that. I can see that's possible. But I don't have anything at first hand. I don't like to put it on tape unless I do.
Okay. It took you a long time, really. Not a long time. But until Hammarskjöld intervened and offered to go to China to release the flyers, to try to release the flyers. But prior to that time, had you had much occasion to be with him, or did the great respect that you had for him seems to have begun with the China situation? Was that true?
I was very surprised and pleased that he would take that initiative, but my association with him was warmer and more frequent when I became president of the UN Correspondents Association. That was 1958.
Yes, I remember, because you've mentioned about how when there were formal stag dinners, mm-hmm. you would be the only woman present in your capacity as the president of the Correspondents Association, and it was your duty then to act as a pool correspondent.
That's
in
right.
such affairs. But I think there was a very unusual thing. I don't recall any other case of certainly not that early in Hammarskjöld's career, where he was as close as he was with you. I refer to that the time when he was flying out to Egypt to accompany the first contingent of the United Nations Emergency Force, and you were on the same plane with him from New York to Italy.
To Rome.
And,
Were you the only correspondent on the plane?
Yeah. Now, did you know that he was going to be on that plane?
Oh yes, the NBC people called me the night before and told me that what plane he was going to be on, and said I must get on that plane. So I talked to some of his aides, and they were all sort of aghast that there'd be a correspondent on the plane. But finally, they said it was okay, and I got my ticket and got on.
Yes, but then I understand that you were in the seat next to him, and you had a chance to talk with him.
Yes, well, we talked a bit that night, or early in the morning, because it was quite late when he came aboard. And I had a chance to talk with Bill Rinaldo, his bodyguard and another man who was with him. And we talked a bit, and we reached Rome. The Secretary General sent me a little note saying that he was sorry to cause me any difficulty in getting a story, but he wondered if we couldn't have sip some brandy and sort of talk. And then he told me the story of a man who had given up his berth on the plane so Dag Hammarskjöld could rest that night, and how kind he thought it was. And then I was able to obtain, in the next few days, a little note that he had sent to the daughter of this man to thank her for her father's generosity. And the little girl said, I said, what kind of a man do you think Dag Hammarskjöld is? And she said, I think he's the kind of man we need to make peace.
Yes. Well, that's that same trip. When you were able to see Dag Hammarskjöld, and I understand that you took one leg of the journey, the UN, he was on his way to the UN military staging area. That's right,
around Naples.
It was Capodichino, I think.
Yeah.
But you had a chance to ride with him in the next seat.
That's right.
And what did you talk about?
Well, we talked in general about a number of things, but he said very clearly that he was quite aware of the fact that when you step out in front in a situation, you can become a target. And he was quite aware of the fact that he would someday become a target, which of course he did. But not over the Suez Crisis so much as the Congo. And when we reached Rome, one of his close friends, who was helping as an aide, came and asked me.
Sorry, I guess my tape had gone out. I think the little Yorkies could do better than I with this.
Carry on where you left off.
One of his very close friends, who was acting as a kind of an aide to him, George Ivan Smith, came up to me and said, would you like to go down to Naples? And I said, would I? And he said, well, you have to be very careful about this, because there are all kinds of people waiting to go, especially correspondents, and they want to go down to Naples too. So he took me out back of the plane. It was an Italian Air Force plane we were going to go in. He took me out back of the plane and smuggled me aboard, so to speak, so that when Dag came aboard, there I sat. And so we had a chance to do a little chatting on the way down to Naples. He explained to me that he couldn't possibly take me into Egypt with the UNIF forces, because they were flying in Swiss planes, and he couldn't possibly take somebody not associated with the UNIF forces aboard. So I had to let go at Naples.
Good old George. I didn't know he was behind that.
Oh, yes.
But he did the same thing so many times when I was in the Congo as spokesman. And I officially had to know nothing about it, but he smuggled a number of correspondents onto UN planes from Leopoldville to Katanga.
Mm. Well, he had a better sense of public relations than Mr. Hammarskjöld.
Oh, and he was very close to Dag. He never forgave himself for not being on the plane the day it crashed.
Well, you know, I was supposed to have been on that plane.
Yes.
I never forgave Linnaeus for not letting me go, because I felt that I should be.
Mm. How did you address him? Was he so formal that you always had to call him Secretary General?
Mr. Secretary General, yes.
You did. You never would call him Dag
no.
or anything. Mm. Dag was only for talking about him when he was not there.
That's right.
He was an amazing editor. I was in charge of the press desk at the time, the UN press desk, and we would do transcripts of his press conferences. The various verbatim reporters would come up and dictate from their stenotype notes directly to our typists in our typing pool. And we at the desk would go go through the stencils, the carbons from the stencils to catch any errors and so forth. And we would send him up copies of our corrections. And in spite of the fact that we had some of the best sort of copy editors in the UN, he would succeed in finding little mistakes, and he'd do it with enormous speed. He would put off his lunch until he'd gone through this with his very neat little notations,
blue-green ink. Blue-green ink.
Well, blue-green ink, sometimes red. Mm. And it was amazing how accurate he was.
Did he primarily have lunch at his desk, or
no.
Except for
in the cuffed, in the dining room?
Yes, he went to the dining room, but at one time I remember he even went across the street to a place called Ferdy's.
Yes, oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
Also known as the Greasy Spoon.
Yeah.
I didn't think that was a greasy spoon. It was pretty good.
But in the main, he ate in the dining room.
Yes, unlike his predecessor Trigby Lee, when he first came into office, on his way to his offices, he would take the high-rise elevator to the 38th floor, which in the past had always been. If Trigby Lee arrived, he was taken up by himself or mm-hmm. with his immediate companions to the 38th floor. But Hammarskjöld said, no, he told the elevator up and the security people, no, let the other people who were going up in the elevator come in.
Uh-huh.
And
he was not just security conscious.
He was went out of his, I'm sure he was security conscious, although there was nowhere near the need for security that now unfortunately exists. But he also made a point of not putting his office in such a way that, just the elevator thing is a perfect example.
He never threw his weight around that.
No, nor did he. He made a genuine, I think, a sincere attempt to be just one of the UN people.
I think I recall seeing him in the cafeteria one day.
Yes,
with
of course he used to go there too.
With the rest of the correspondents. And I wanted to say that when he arrived, the morale at the UN was very low because of we'd been through the McCarthy period. And Ambassador Lodge coming in to check the loyalty of Americans mm-hmm. working for the UN. And one of the first things Dag Hammarskjöld did, as far as I can remember, was to go to every office in that building mm-hmm. and shake hands with every single employee. I remember his coming down to the bullpen of the press section mm-hmm. and he had to shake hands with everybody and have a word or two with them, which I think improved morale a great deal.
Was he always formal with you? Were you always Miss Frederick, or were you
yes
never Pauline? Or
mm-mm. Not to my face. Whether he used it behind my back, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
He may have.
But another word about his dining habits, which reflects the difference. Trigby Lee used to have table number one in the delegates' dining room. That's the table in the corner of the dining room, the north-east corner.
Yeah.
And Hammarskjöld never took that table. When he did dine in the dining room, it was always at table number four. If it was vacant.
That was along the side.
Yes, it was along the north side.
Yes, I remember.
Was he a man who arrived at the office at 6 o'clock in the morning, or?
Well, sometimes he wouldn't go home. He'd stay all night and work. That's the night, especially the night he went down to the meditation room. Mm-hmm. But once the troops were deployed in the Congo and elsewhere, he would work almost round the clock. Mm-hmm.
It was his apartment near the UN?
He had in the on the 38th floor, as part of his office suite, there was a small bedroom and a bathroom and a kitchenette attached to it. I don't think he used that much. As I understand, the only person who ever used the bath and the bathroom was John F. Kennedy when he came to make a speech, and he was having back trouble.
Nice.
So they cleaned the bathtub out for him, and they let him take a hot bath.
The UN doesn't maintain an apartment for the Secretary General.
The apartment still exists.
No, I mean not in the UN building.
Oh, yeah, the UN...
As far as home quarters.
The UN provides the Secretary General's accommodations. Trygve Lie had a rather luxurious house in Forest Hills.
Mm-hmm.
And then some very kind and wealthy people in Sutton Place, who had an apartment, a house in Sutton Place, townhouse, mm-hmm. made that available to the...
Wasn't it the Rockefellers?
No.
Wasn't it the Rockefellers?
I don't know. Well, actually, the whole property belonged to the Rockefellers. And the Rockefellers gave it to the as a gift to the UN. It was worth about $8.5 million at the time, I think. But at the same time, after the UN had established its headquarters there, the value of Rockefeller-owned properties all around the former UN site, mm-hmm. which, as you know, used to be slaughterhouses and very depressed. It multiplied. So whatever $8.5 million or whatever it was the Rockefellers gave to the UN was a very
paid off
a lucrative
for
gift for them
in the long
the
run.
End.
But I didn't know that Hammarskjöld stayed at Sutton Place, did he?
No, he didn't.
He didn't have the house.
Uthant was Secretary General when...
Yes.
When, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, of course,
didn't
Waldheim...
Didn't have the house
then. Waldheim succeeded him.
So where did Hammarskjöld live?
Hammarskjöld
wasn't
had
it about 62nd Street. Someplace.
Yes, he had an apartment in town, and he had a place out in
Brewster.
Yeah,
near Margie Britter's.
Uh huh.
She.
Did you ever go there?
To not to his house, but to the Britter's. I've been. Margie tells about a couple of men coming up one day and crossing her property or something like that, and she went out. And I think one of them was shooting something. It doesn't sound right, but anyway. Doing something that isn't ordinarily done there, and she went out and scolded the person and said, by the way, what's your name? And it was Dag Hammarskjöld and Bill Ronello.
But had he gotten friendly with the neighbors there at all? Did he?
No.
After all, Ritter had been a correspondent, had
Ritter,
he not?
Mm-hmm. Of Times of London.
Uh-huh.
I think that was just that one time that he stopped there.
Uh-huh.
He was walking across the fields.
Mm-hmm.
He liked to walk and be out of doors.
It was pretty hard to keep up with him when he went walking.
Oh, he stride. He wouldn't walk, he'd just stride. Even through the halls, I could see him with a couple of aides going down the hall, just way ahead of them.
The aides were trotting.
And they were running practically to keep up with him.
He was fluent in four languages, is that right?
At least four.
But
Swedish, English, French,
German. I'm sure he must.
Oh, yes,
because
he
used to read that German philosopher,
Hans Buber. Hans Buber.
Oh, he translated that.
Him, didn't
he? Martin Buber.
Martin Buber.
Martin Buber. Yes.
Martin. I think so.
Where did he have time to do this? He smoked cigars, didn't he?
Oh, little
small cigars. Cigarillos.
Can you smoke in the assembly or in the security council? Do they smoke allowed? Can they smoke there?
Oh, yes. In fact, they provide ashtrays. They used to. I assume they still do.
Oh, I don't know.
But he was so formal and so disciplined. Would he smoke in the assembly or would he?
Smoking
he was
in those,
a doodler, wasn't he?
Smoking in those days was generally done, as you might remember, unlike nowadays.
Was there anything that showed the correspondent's special respect or admiration for him in any way? Did they ever present him with anything? Because I gather that the respect that you had for him was not extraordinary, that the most of the reporters thought highly of him.
Well, I think that was true, but I don't know that we gave him any token of our regard.
Mm-hmm. And when he came to the, you had him at the Correspondents Association, didn't he speak there?
Yes.
And did he then talk off the cuff? Because as a one-time reporter myself, I think he must have been the most difficult subject to ever get a story from.
He was.
Did he ever talk off the cuff?
Not really. You don't remember, do you?
Yes, I have. I mean, I used to go to all those UN Correspondents Association luncheons. Sometimes he could be quite witty in sort of off the cuff remarks. He had a sense of humor too. That was one of the.
He did have that.
Things a lot of people forget.
Mm-hmm. I can't remember anything. It was very witty. Uh-huh. Were you at the correspondence luncheon the day old Bokhari caved in?
Yes.
What do you mean?
Bokhari was a Pakistani who accompanied Doug Hammarskjöld on his trip to Peking. And he was a rather odd person. I'll leave it at that. He was bright, brilliant. Brilliant man, but rather odd.
Intellectual.
But what happened at this lunch?
Well, Bokhari had been having some difficulty of some kind. We heard about it, but we didn't see it. And at this luncheon, at the correspondence luncheon, all of a sudden he started going down like this.
And he fell asleep?
No. He was sick.
Oh.
We assume he was sick.
Maybe he had something to drink?
Well, Dag went over to him and sort of pushed him around a little bit and got him up, took him out.
Well, he does seem like he's a most remarkable man.
Mm-hmm. He was. His like will not be seen again for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody would be selfless enough to take that job.
I remember when Bokhari came back with Hammarskjöld after the trip to Peking, he gave a press conference. And all he had to say about Peking, well, actually, it was the tail end of Hammarskjöld had a press conference, and Bokhari was present and was asked to answer questions too. He later became, you know, the acting head of the Department of Public Information. But he was asked a number of questions, but the only thing that he could talk about was how cold it was in Peking. Which to me, from being an old Pekingese, seemed to be a rather inadequate way of...
How did Hammarskjöld dress? Always in diplomatic dark suits, or did he ever wear a sports jacket? Did he
bow ties frequently?
Bow ties, yes. Oh, that would be indicating
in the summertime. Anyway.
I don't remember. I guess he wore a sports jacket. Certainly, when he'd be out plowing around the countryside, he'd wear sports jackets.
Away from the public eye. He was very neat, wasn't he?
Oh, yes.
Was he very neat in his office too? Was he one of those executives that always has a clear desk?
I think he
did. He was very neat. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And didn't he bring in the paintings from the Modern Gallery?
Museum of Modern Art?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
For his office.
Yeah.
They were borrowed.
Yes, they would, on loan, they would make them available for him, so he had them hanging in his office. He also was one to whom, in the name of the United Nations, they loaned that lovely tapestry rendition of Picasso's Woman Descending a Staircase or a Ladder or something, which it was beautiful. It used to hang in the south, outside the south lounge.
Well, he was very advanced in his feeling for art.
Yes, and some of his just the things that he chose, mind you, before he came, there were all kinds of so-called art objects given to the United Nations, despite the fact that when Trigvi Lee was Secretary General, they had an international panel of artists, world famous artists, to pass on the acceptability of gifts of art.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of junk was unloaded on the UN. That committee never met, as far as I know.
Huh?
But when Hammarskjöld took over, there was a distinct upgrading of the of the
and the taste yeah. there.
And he worked with the committee in planning the concerts at the UN.
Oh yes, and he was very. One time the security guards came out in new uniforms, looking like sort of Texan types, you know, with the black lapel cover, you know, the black pocket covers and stuff, looking like the rough
Texas riders.
Yes, and he took one look at them on his way into the office, gave the order that those uniforms had to go, which they did. I could see my red light blinking again, so I. We can